This is Ann Dalton reading for Sun Sounds for the program Are We There Yet? Today I have a special trip to New Zealand. In 2023, I saw an ad for a 7-day trail ride through Globetrotters on the Northern Island of New Zealand. Well, I'd been on a trail ride in my 20s and had fond memories of it and had to go. And I'd always wanted to see New Zealand. So in February of last year, I took a 12-hour flight from San Francisco to Auckland, New Zealand. Even though the trail ride was 7 days long, I thought as long as I was going that far, I might as well spend more than a week there, and planned a vacation for 4.5 weeks touring the North and South Islands. After my rather impulsive booking for this trip, I began to think about how many years it had been since I spent 4 to 6 hours a day in a saddle, and thought I might need some coaching to get in shape. I found Anna Bergenstrahler's site on the internet. She taught riding fitness, and I signed up for 5 weeks of training through several exercises via Zoom meetings meant to help me be more balanced in the saddle. That turned out to be a really good idea. I didn't realize how wonky my posture had gotten over the years. And when you're on a horse's back, it's really important to be balanced so you can be comfortable and give consistent messages to your horse. As we prepared to land in Auckland, it was breathtaking to see this spit of land surrounded by the Tasman Sea to the west, the Pacific Ocean to the east, and the Southern Ocean to the south. Living in a desert, water never fails to excite me. Rather than renting a car, I chose public transportation to get around, not wanting to test my left-hand side driving skills. It was a fortunate choice because I met many nice people on the buses and trains, like Ursula, who offered to put me up at her house on Lake Rotorua if I came back to town, and Lindsay, who talked me into trying a Coke and brandy in the Powderhorn Chateau Bar. My big goal in heading for Paihia at the northern tip of the North Island was to go diving in the pristine marine preserve in the Bay of Islands. Mother Nature had other ideas, though, and the dive was canceled due to heavy winds that day. Having already locked in my travel plans, I could not hang around long enough to rebook. But what was bad for diving was good for sailing, and I booked a day trip on the R. Tucker Thompson sailboat. This sailboat is a gaff-rigged, square-top sail schooner with a full-sail wardrobe of 9 sails. The ship's overall length is 85 feet, and her height is 21 meters. Her appearance is majestic, and prior to her current mission of giving youth a life-changing experience, it was in several movies. Besides the morning scones covered in cream and jam and a yummy midday meal, we had the chance to climb the rigging, help steer the ship, and hike on an island. The after-lunch entertainment was thrilling because guests could swing on a rope off the tall sidearm, splashing into the water a few yards below. I really wished I'd brought my bathing suit. The ship itself is used to promote underprivileged youth, and the teens on board were enthusiastic about the crewing experience. Mangus, the operations manager, told me about the mission of this nonprofit, and then 2 crew members, Lucy and Hetty, talked about their experience on board. It's fair to say that we do work to get kids who perhaps come from slightly underprivileged backgrounds to get them onboarding, give them the opportunity to develop confidence, and develop skills they may not otherwise be getting at home, Mangus said. Lucy, one of the teen crew members, said, "The more work we put in, the more likely we are to get, like, a proper job. We definitely learn patience and perseverance. It teaches us really good life skills in the process of learning how to sail, and also just teaches me how to communicate with people, kind of like customer service, like being able to talk to people, just being friendly, even if you're just really tired. Hetty said, "Before this, I wasn't the sort of person who would ask for help, but I know that if I'm on here, they will give me help." That was a great day. Eventually, the wind calmed down, and we sailed back to port with a beautiful sunset. The next stop was Waiheke Island, just a 48-minute ferry ride from Auckland and a 10-minute walk from my room to the beach. I took a ride out to Orangatiki Beach, which was rated as the nicest. Since February 6th was a national holiday and so many wineries were closed there, I treasured the opportunity to sit on the beach and eat huge chicken wings and have some beer in the local restaurant before returning to my room. While the ferry boat was returning to Auckland, I was tipped off to the best gelato in town right at the wharf and found it did live up to the hype. I had a double chocolate cone. Another mind-blowing experience was visiting the Auckland Art Museum that offered a 10-room display of the famous Chinese dress designer Guo Pei's dresses with videos on her fashion shows. I've never heard of her, but could immediately see how she had become famous. Her styles were extremely creative, colorful, and very unique. I understand that many movie stars from the U.S. go to this dress designer to come up with unique dresses for the red carpet. I made a stop at the aquarium founded by the diver Kelly Tarleton, with live penguins diving in and out of the water and some octopus and other creatures in tanks. I next took a bus to Okuni to do what was described as a scenic outing, riding bicycles along the old coach road, advertised as a wonderful family outing. Once I was paired up with my electric bike, which I was told I needed due to the inclines on the trail, and headed out, I realized no parents in their right mind would bring their child on a trail like this, narrow and rocky, on a bike that felt like a runaway horse. I wiped out in the ditch and called to be picked up. The man who took me back to the bike shop was very nice. I next passed through Hamilton by bus, where I tasted some more delicious scones with my coffee and walked around a bit before boarding the bus again. Further south in Rotorua, I took a nighttime canopy tree tour among the giant redwoods imported from California. New Zealand trees grow very slowly, and the government realized the potential of a timber supply shortage in 1897. So it established trial plantations of faster-growing trees to provide the country's future timber needs. As a result, some 70 species of trees exist now in New Zealand. Ironically, California redwoods actually grow taller and faster in the New Zealand soil than they do in California, although they are more easily damaged there, and we were discouraged from touching them. The next day, I hiked in the forest. The tall fern trees were beautiful and fascinating. Rotorua is known for its steamy environment due to the many hot springs and geothermal sites. You can go to watch geysers or sit in the natural hot springs throughout the area. After my visit to Rotorua, it was time for the trail ride. I was staying in Taupō, where I'd taken a sailboat trip out to a beautiful rock carving. A van came to pick us all up to make the 2.5-hour drive out to the River Valley Ranch. While I was on the van, I met some of the other women I was going to be traveling with. I found out I was in a fairly international group with some people from Denmark, British Columbia, Australia, and of course, New Zealand. They were much younger than my 75 years, which is always exhilarating in itself. Some of them had their own horses and rode a lot. Some rode a lot, but didn't have their own horses. Some were self-taught and hadn't had any formal lessons. I was in the middle. I rode periodically and had had lots of lessons. So we all qualified as intermediate riders, which you had to be on this trail ride. Nicola McGaw, Brian, her husband, and her daughter, Janie Harrison, ran the lodge. It is a fifth-generation family-owned lodge that sits on the wild Rangitiki River and is located in the middle of the North Island, surrounded by country most tourists don't see. The rest of the day was spent getting lessons on how to ride with rope halters rather than the reins and bits as I was used to at home. The horses make most of the decisions on how to navigate the very hilly terrain. Us riders only signaled with our hands when we wanted them to change their speed or direction. The horses seemed bigger and more powerful than what I was used to in the U.S. Some were part of the Kaminawa horse breed. These horses are a population of feral horses in New Zealand that are descended from domestic horses released in the 19th and 20th centuries. They're known for their hardiness and quiet temperament. We learned that there are no natural predators in New Zealand for the horse or deer populations, and so there is a large amount of both on the islands. In the past, the horses and deer were routinely gathered up and slaughtered annually to keep the numbers down and to protect the environment from overgrazing and destroying fragile ecosystems. But in 2014, advocate groups for horses created the Wild Stallion Challenge, which allowed ranchers to put their names in a hat and be matched with two wild horses to tame. The program has been a success. I'll tell you more about that later. While staying on one of the farms, we prepared for a visit to a real Maori farm. Maoris are the original inhabitants of New Zealand. Hazel, our cook on the trail, and a Maori herself, taught us the song used in accepting the welcome of the Maori to their land. We had an exchange of songs and speeches between ourselves and the tribe, and then were treated to a delicious lunch called a kai, and had the opportunity to ask the residents questions about their lives and heritage. While in New Zealand, it was interesting to notice the interweaving of the Maori culture within the general culture. Maori, the indigenous people of Aotearoa, New Zealand, arrived there more than 800 years ago from Polynesia. Over the centuries, they've developed their own traditions and culture, deeply rooted in respect for nature, community, and their kamatua, or elders. These traditional beliefs and practices have contributed to the Maori people's resilience and continue to shape their lives today. They are also fundamental to the New Zealand way of life, influencing everything from cultural values in language to public policy. This includes the increasing use of the Maori language, the strengthening of tribal structures and councils, capitalizing on tribally owned assets, and establishing Maori media and broadcasting outlets. Recent census figures show the number of Maori has surpassed 1 million people, which means 1 in 5 New Zealanders is now of Maori descent. This is a significant milestone for Maori, whose population plummeted to 42,000 in the 1890s. European settlement in the 19th century had a devastating impact on Maori. Not only did they succumb to introduced diseases, but poverty, loss of land, and social fragmentation, which significantly reduced life expectancy. Getting back to our visit at the farm, that night we slept on mattresses spread out on the floor in the marae, which is the ceremonial house, as Maori do while holding a funeral there to keep the departed company until burial. The walls were hung with pictures of many ancestors who had passed. After leaving the Maori farm and riding another day, we took a refreshing dip in the Rangitiki River to cool off. It was cold, but refreshing. That night, some of us slept in tents in the yard, others in the farmhouse, always to wake up the next morning to a great breakfast. The cots were comfortable, and the hot water bottles were appreciated too, since it got fairly cool in the evenings. We stayed in the high country while riding through private farms. It was natural to feel small in comparison to this wonderful expanse of green hills that rolled and wandered into the horizon. As we continued through the high country farmlands, we had lots of opportunities to pick up the pace. With the wind blowing through our hair, there is no freer feeling than galloping up the hill on a powerful horse, catching our breath at the top. Our horses crossed the river multiple times en route to the Toronto Lodge, our final destination before returning to the ranch for the last evening. I was glad the horses navigated the crossings with their unshod hooves, and even they seemed more cautious than usual. The river bottom was covered with round, small, and medium-sized rocks that would have been guaranteed ankle twisters for a mere human. The Toronto Lodge is based high on the cliffs of the Rangitiki River and gave us some stunning views into the river canyon. Inside it was a natural gathering place for the group where snacks and drinks were enjoyed along with card games. Later that afternoon, Nicola asked who wanted to swim bareback in the river, and that was just too good to pass up. It took 5 tries to get Ranger, my horse, in the swimming mode, but he finally went for it, and I was grateful. I hung on to his mane and let him navigate the river. We emerged on the other side to cheers from the group. Returning to the River Valley Lodge for our last night, we were treated to a heiki, which is a traditional Maori feast. The food, which included lamb and chicken and lots of fresh farm vegetables, is placed in muslin sacks in a large hole in the ground on top of heated stones. It is then covered over with dirt and wet burlap sacks and cooks all day. Our cook, Tommy Wara, was one of the original participants in the Wild Stallion Challenge, which I mentioned earlier in this broadcast. Since the cooking took all day, he took the time to give me an interview about that experience. His horse trailer is emblazoned with some beautiful photographs of him riding those horses. He said you never knew what you were getting when the horses arrived, and it was your job to see if they could be trained to ride. So instead of just trying to grab hold of them to bring them into his world, what he did was wait until they let him into their world. And then they started working together. He told me that since they've had the Wild Stallion Challenge, no horses have been put down since. That night, after a delicious dinner, Jamie offered more opportunities for fun and adventure for the following morning before our lunchtime departure. Several decided to do the whitewater rafting. I passed on this for the opportunity to sit calmly by the river with its tall waterfall down the hill from the ranch house and reflect on the wonderful experiences we'd had that week. It was then time to travel to South Island after a short flight on the New Zealand Airlines. My first day was in Nelson, which had the lovely Tahuna Nui Beach, where I spent a day or two, beaches being one of my favorite places to be. I was able to walk to the beach from my hotel room. Based on a tip from my taxi driver, I headed out to Mapua, a small town about 30 minutes from Nelson that was charming and had craft stores and a great restaurant and an ice cream shop with fresh berries. Everything was so peaceful. I felt like I was sitting in the middle of a postcard. While still in Nelson, I booked a ride on a whale-watching ship. We were looking for sperm whales, which were known to be in the waters there that time of year. We did see the pre-emerging spout of the whale as he blew air out of his blowhole. The sperm whale is the largest of the toothed whales, easily recognized by its enormous square head and narrow lower jaw. Males can be as long as 78.7 feet and weigh up to 55 tons. This one stayed on the surface about 20 minutes before flipping his tail up and diving back down again. After that, we went to another spot and watched the Hector Maui dolphins cavorting in the water. These are the smallest breed of dolphins and very cute. Mature adults have a total length of 3 feet 11 inches to 5 feet and weigh about 132 pounds. I reserved the last day in Nelson to take the city bus into town and visit the Souter Art Gallery. It had some great stuff there. I loved the gift shop and bought some jewelry on my way back. I next visited a small vacation town called Akaroa by train one day to see more sea life. It was cloudy and rainy, and we really didn't see much sea life. But we had a lovely lunch in a nice restaurant, and I visited a wool shop with beautiful merino wool sweaters and also a muskrat blanket. Do you know that New Zealand has too many muskrats and possums? They're trying to get rid of them. The Australian brush-tailed possum, which is very different from the American possum, was first released in New Zealand in 1837, becoming successfully established around 1858. This was done with the express purpose of establishing a commercial fur trade. Without natural predators, though, this furry cat-sized marsupial thrived in the lush New Zealand native bush and quickly became a major ecological problem, killing native trees and competing with native animals and birds for food. But in the meantime, restaurants and clothing stores are making the best of it and use the possums and muskrats for food as well as blending in with merino wool for garments. Actually, muskrat fur is very soft. I didn't try the possum stew that was advertised in a local place, however, so can't tell you what that tastes like. I do remember being served fried muskrat on a trail ride in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina once. It tasted like a cross between chicken and pork, so it was good. On to Blenheim. I was really looking forward to a wine tour in the Marlborough region since my favorite Sauvignon Blanc comes from there. Our tour guide was Dave, a retired farmer who talked about the imported labor it takes to harvest the grapes and prepare the vines for the next season. Dave said, "We're quite lucky in this region with the availability of manpower. They come out here on short-term work contracts and mostly from the Pacific Islands. Vanuatu, Fiji, Samoa, Tahiti, and Thailand. They will come out here and they may work anywhere between 2 to 6 months depending on the amount of work that's available. But right now, there would be pretty close to 1,600 young people here, and they will be very, very involved in the hand-picking of the grapes. But post-harvest, then they will be into the pruning, and that will go on from late May and right through until probably September. Just bear in mind that we have 70,000 acres of grape vineyards here. We got the history on the founding family that owned this particular vineyard, which actually made champagne back in France. They don't call it champagne here. As we learned from the champagne rules, they have to put the words method traditionnel since they can't say champagne. My final stop in the islands was in Queenstown. What a lovely place. The sign outside one tour shop said, "Gravity is a toy, come and play." Any adventure you might want to go on is there. Visiting the area where The Hobbit was shot, bungee jumping, kayaking, hot air balloon rides, the waterfront with all its restaurants and music. On March 2nd, I signed up for a sunrise hot air balloon ride over Queenstown. I've been on balloon rides before, other places, but this was really special, and we looked out with clear skies and a gorgeous sunrise. I was able to call my sister Tiz in Alexandria, Virginia through WhatsApp. She was surprised. We went up to 6,000 feet before heading back to Earth. Rock, the pilot, was a happy guy, and we were served the traditional bubbly wine and pastries after landing and helping to put up the huge balloon. The very last day, I took a bus to famous Milford Sound, stopping at the Mirror Lakes, which were beautiful on the way. The Milford Sound is actually a fjord carved out by giant glaciers 400 million years ago. When you think about that, it looks all the more fantastic. We got up close and personal to some of the tall waterfalls showering down from the tops of the rocks. The next day, I flew home. I would go back in a minute. There is a sense here of closeness with and respect for nature. The people were friendly, and the scenery, of course, was beautiful. It was magical every day. That's about all the time we have today. And I'll end with thought for the day from Winston Churchill, who said, "An appeaser is someone who feeds a crocodile, hoping it will eat him last." This is Ann Dalton reading for Sun Sounds for the program Are We There Yet? If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on broadcast information and audio, then under program links, left click on demand podcasts. You can now listen to SunSounds podcasts on your Echo Dot or other smartphone devices. And this is Ann Dalton signing off from Are We There Yet?